You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, welcome to Speak Up for Monday, December 1st. Just 25 days till Christmas now. Thanks for joining us this morning. My name is Magnus Teevil. Joining me in the studio are...
Peter R.H.
Stephen Fan.
And we've got a bunch of stuff lined up for you. We're going to start off with a report about a statement issued by the BC Human Rights Commission about the need to prioritize evidence over stigma when addressing the toxic drug crisis, which, of course... almost 10 years after being declared a public health emergency, still plagues the province. Stephen, you're here to talk about some arts.
Yeah, I saw a show by Vancouver City Opera called Salam Shalom, Echoes of Home. And it is a sort of a great musical celebration, musical evening, uniting Arab and Jewish artists from Canada. And so maybe I'll talk a little bit about that.
And Peter, what are you going to be talking about?
Well, the big news was about the possible repeal of the oil tanker ban on the North British Columbia coast. And a lot has been said about it. I think I'm going to add maybe, hopefully, what's not been said, which has been quite a bit. The show previous to ours has had about 25 minutes on it, mm-hmm. and the competition from like 8:37 to 9 on CBC Radio, they said a bit about it. But I think I'll add a few more insights. Hopefully, there'll be a reason to hear what I have to say.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Peter. That'll be up towards the end of the program. We also have a report from our friends at CHLY in Nanaimo about issues that the UBCM, or the Union of BC Municipalities, which is the sort of organization that brings together municipalities throughout the province of British Columbia, and they have an annual meeting where they all get together and talk about what they like and don't like, and the province and other big players show up to meet with the municipalities, and they have some issues with the provincial bill that would fast track housing in BC. So we're going to hear about that as well, and plus some good music as well. All right, we're going to get started off though with this story from Danny Nesvadarani right here at CJSF, our LJI reporter, talking to Kasen Govender about the BC Human Rights Commission's position on how we need to be dealing with the toxic drug crisis and respecting human rights as we do it.
Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvadarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On November 13th, BC Human Rights Commissioner Kasari Govender released a statement regarding the provincial government's ongoing response to BC's toxic drug crisis. In the statement, Govender calls on the BC government to emphasize evidence-based policies in order to address the crisis, accusing their current focus on criminalization and involuntary care as being influenced by stigma. To learn more about Govender's statement, as well as what proposed actions she believes the province should be taking in order to address the toxic drug crisis, we sat down for a conversation where she was able to explain her reasons for releasing this statement.
So we released a position statement on the toxic drug crisis. In many ways, it reflects what many experts in the field have been saying for a long time, and it brings that into a human rights perspective, essentially arguing that, you know, in order to respect the human rights of folks directly who are directly impacted, people who use substances, who come from all walks of life, some of whom deal with substance dependence, addiction, but some of whom don't. All folks, to prioritize their rights, we need to take policy steps that are rooted in the evidence rather than in ideology. So that means prioritizing, for example, safe supply, access to safe supply, and harm reduction services, rather than emphasizing criminal law responses to the toxic drug crisis.
We then asked Governor to expand on her statement that the BC government's actions towards the toxic drug crisis were being driven by stigma of drug use and drug users.
I worry that the response has been based on, in part at least, on kind of an understanding that, you know, prioritizing, first of all, kind of the perspective that this is about safety on our streets for non-drug users, rather than prioritizing the lives and the human rights of those who do use substances. That's not to say that all of us don't want safe streets, that all of us benefit from communities where we feel like ourselves and our families, our children are safe in our parks and in our public spaces. We absolutely do. And happily for us, getting more safety in our streets and our parks is the same as respecting people's human rights who actually use drugs, which is we need a solution to this problem. You know, a lot of people in the wake of this, with much of the negative comments in the wake of releasing the statement have been, you don't care about the problem. You don't care about the people who are dying. You just think people should be able to kind of use drugs and as much as they want, and you're sort of promoting their suffering. In fact, this is the opposite. This is about saying what actually addresses the toxicity of drugs. These are the substances that are killing people or causing serious brain damage. You know, let's actually get to what the real solutions are. And the evidence shows that the real solutions lie in these kinds of public policy responses that may not intuitively at first feel right. But it's not about what's intuitive. It's actually about what the evidence supports. So I very much want to address the toxic drug supply. I very much want to ensure that people are not dying and seriously injured through toxic drugs. And ultimately, that will make all of us safer, whether we're directly impacted by this crisis from someone we love in our lives or ourselves, or just because we see this around us in our communities.
Later on in our conversation, we asked Kasari Govender to provide examples of different places in Canada as well as the world that have enacted policies similar to what she is advocating for.
I mean, I think every context is different for sure. When we can look to certain countries in Europe, we can look to Portugal and others to see how some of these policies have rolled out. Unfortunately, you know, the evidence from Canada either hasn't been listened to or hasn't been given enough time to play out. So, but we can see the evidence of how we've done so far under a prohibition model. Under a model where access to substances is illegal, rather than the focus being on the safety of the substances that people are accessing. And we can see that because this drug toxicity crisis has arisen in the context of a prohibition model. It's arisen in the context of the existing, you know, legal structure, which says that drugs are criminalized and that therefore we wouldn't try to make the drug supply safer. We would just try to eliminate it altogether. Well, that's great in theory, but that actually hasn't worked. That's exactly what gave rise to this situation in the first place.
Lastly, Kasari Govender left us with some more suggestions for what she believes needs to be prioritized when addressing the toxic drug crisis in BC.
So in my view, it's this position, again, despite how it's sometimes being represented, this position is not opposed to all forms of involuntary care. Sometimes involuntary care can be the right step from a human rights perspective if it is the last resort. If the science backs up that people will actually come out better than healthier than they went in, and that they have the right safeguards in place so that they can challenge the fact that they're being detained against their will or the conditions under which they're being detained. Those are all vital elements of having an involuntary care system. But even before we get to that point, we need to ask ourselves where we're spending all of our energy in term and money and resources in terms of addressing this crisis. But where we need to be spending that is getting access to treatment options that exist now voluntarily. Putting aside for a second, we need access to safe supply, we need harm reduction facilities, we also need access to voluntary mental health services. You know, I think probably everyone listening, I certainly can draw multiple examples from my community, that my community of loved ones, families and family and friends, of folks who tried desperately to get access to services and were unable to do it. And that worsened their mental health, it worsened their reliance on substances because there just weren't the resources available at that front end. Let's invest properly in services where people can actually choose to access services. That is a human rights respecting model, respects people's agency. But in addition to that, we also respect the science. I'm not a scientist, I'm a lawyer. That's partly why we put together this statement, so that we could look at the evidence out there and ensure that, you know, we weren't basing this kind of legal model in something that doesn't have actual basis in life. But what we see is that the evidence backs up the use of voluntary care services, and backs up safe supply, backs up harm reduction. And so we know that, you know, there's some really problematic evidence about what happens when people are put into involuntary care only for substance use disorder. So were they not for other mental health issues, but only for substance use disorder. And then they come out and sometimes are more vulnerable and are more likely to overdose and die as a result. So we need to make sure that we gain we're making policy decisions that are actually based in the evidence.
Once again, that was our conversation with BC Human Rights Commissioner Kasari Govender on a statement she made where she claims that the BC government is currently addressing the toxic drug crisis through policies that stem from stigma rather than evidence. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
And thanks to Danny for that report. Stephen Fan is in the studio with us, and you've been out getting cultured.
Well, trying to anyways. there was a really interesting performance by the Vancouver City Opera on the weekend. It was on a Saturday. And it was actually a one-performance show, so they only had one performance, but it was at the SFU Goldcorp Center for the Arts downtown, which is a really nice venue, actually, because it's sort of set up for all sorts of stage performances. But in this instance, it's a performance called Salam Shalom, Echoes of Home. And it's primarily kind of an operatic musical program brought together by two celebrated singers. The singers are Jacqueline Grossman, the soprano, and Mariam Khalil, a twice Juno-nominated soprano as well, with piano accompaniment by Gordon Gerard and artistic support from Edan Cohen. And
so this is sort of like a kind of a small combo performance, because often when we think of opera, we think of sort of the big production and the you know, the full symphony and all that stuff, but this is smaller and more intimate?
Yeah, this is more really kind of a selection of numbers
right. From
the opera. So, for example, what you can do is go to Opera Pops, and they will give you kind of celebrated arias and so forth. And this is kind of what it was, but with kind of a slightly different twist on the material. Mm. It's a blend of traditional Jewish and Palestinian Arabic folk songs and lullabies and other artistic inventions, which obviously represents an attempt at sort of cultural representation and communication on the parts of the performers and the people who organized the show. And it was really lovely, and they had some really interesting songs, and so I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very moving.
Excellent. So when is it on?
It was on Saturday.
Oh, okay.
Normally I would do a preview, but in this case it was kind of last minute,
yeah.
And I thought I'd just come on the Monday after and give my sort of a little spiel about it.
Excellent. So is this part of a series they're doing?
It looks like a one-off, but they're probably going to do other similar types of events, perhaps partly responding to what's mm-hmm. available, perhaps responding to world events. But it's Vancouver City Opera in general is kind of interesting in that sense because Vancouver has two opera companies. Mm-hmm. The big one, the standard one, Vancouver Opera, they put on traditional operatic performances, and the City Opera, which does more kind of experimental, more unique stuff, mm-hmm. sometimes modern operas.
Yeah.
Last time they had a kind of a early 20th century operetta. I'm very interested in both. And so it was always kind of an eye-opening experience for me to go. And in this instance, is also very meaningful and in a really lovely venue, and I had a really good time.
Excellent. Do you have their website?
I do. The website. Do you want me to read from the program or?
Sure.
Yeah. So yeah, the programs had the website is cityoperavancouver.org, I assume. It's an organization, so I think it's probably .org. You can't really see it on the phone. But the selection of programs includes and weaves together Arab and Jewish artistic traditions, languages, stories, to create a space for connection through music. It includes Eli, Mermaid Songs, Ikola Bavka, and Ire, but I was kind of looking through the program was before the performance. There are some really really interesting songs, like Nani Nani, number 7 with music by Manuel Garcia Morante, which is a collection of traditional Sephardic songs and carefully preserved and arranged for piano and voice, which sort of offer a rare glimpse into the musical heritage of that diaspora. The lyrics go something like Nani, 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 that the son of the mother, even while young, will do great things. I, sleep my soul, sleep my life, that your father comes with much happiness. I, open the door to me, open it, my madame, that I come very tired from plowing the fields. Oh, I will open the door to you, since you are so tired, and will see the sleeping boy in the cradle. So it's kind of this lovely lullaby. Right. Another one, which I won't read because I don't want to just take up more.
It's not quite the same as the singing.
It's just not, especially since my voice is not that of an operatic soprano, yeah. Right? Like it's not the same thing. But there's some really interesting ones as well. And there's one called Ya'ana Amzasha from Ire, and the poet is Yehuda Halevi. Mm-hmm. Halevi. Music by Osvaldo Golijev, and it's a dynamic work blending Hebrew and Arabic poetry, intertwining Sephardic traditions with modern compositions, features a Hebrew prayer alongside the evocative poetry of Palestinian writer Mahmoud Darwish. So a lot of it was sung in sort of these languages, sometimes with translations versus in translation. It was just kind of a very fascinating experience in that sense.
Well, great. Well, thanks for bringing that to us, Steve.
A pleasure.
So you can find more about that performance and others that are coming up at City Opera's website, which is cityoperavancouver.com. And they have a whole list of their upcoming productions, and you can check it all out there. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you very much.
All right, next up we have we're going to have Bird Note, and then we'll be back with a story about how municipalities have some issues with the province's effort to press them to speed up housing construction. But first, here's Bird Note.
Is Bird Note. It's early morning in Costa Rica. We're in a mixed tropical and temperate forest where a stream runs to the Pacific. Tiny bats nestle in a tree after a night on the wing. A great kiskadee calls. And gray-capped flycatchers sally forth from willow-like shrubs to catch insects in midair. Now a dozen white ibis, large, graceful birds with curved pink bills, fly by in silent formation, low to the water. Deep in a thicket, two black-hooded ant shrikes call. It's only 8 a.m., yet the heat and humidity are rising. By noon, a few black vultures will be eating the remains of an iguana. Chestnut-mandibled toucans will shift lazily from one tree to another. We'll lie low until the sounds of cicadas give way to the sounds of crickets. In the tropics, darkness falls quickly. Tonight, however, the moon is full, and a chorus like no other begins to pour forth. The calls of Bufo marinus, marine toads. The land is pulsing with life. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Ducks Unlimited Canada works with landowners and other conservation-minded partners to improve outcomes for communities and wildlife. Supporting vital ecosystems which contribute to water quality and quantity, soil health, support agriculture and economy, mitigate severe weather events, and provide opportunities for recreational access to nature. Together, we are unlimited. Learn more about programs and partnerships at ducks.ca.
All right, let's give you an update on the weather for this week. Guess what? It's December, and that means it's not going to be terribly nice this week. So it's a lot of clouds and rain throughout the week. The sun's going to apparently peak up for a little while tomorrow, so it'll be a little brighter then. But basically, it's pretty much the same all week. Highs between 6 and 8 degrees, showers throughout the week, clouds and overcast, lows down to anywhere from 2 to 4 degrees, coming up to about overnight lows of or highs, 5 degrees later in the week. So I guess make sure you take your umbrella, make sure you wear some warm clothes and a waterproof coat, and you'll be fine.
I mean, I heard that it's started snowing on the slopes, which is helpful, although I spoke to people who were in Whistler this weekend, and they said they didn't see any powder. So we'll see.
I was in Whistler last weekend, like not the one just passed, but the one before that.
Okay.
Which was apparently opening weekend.
Yeah, I was going to say, that is opening weekend.
Opening weekend, but there was not a lot of snow. I think you could see on the, they have a, at the bottom lifts in the village, they have a big board that shows you what runs are going, and there was one run going.
Yeah, it's not great. I mean, like, early season is not great, you know, generally, but, like, Whistler, the problem is, even when it's good, and you're going there on the weekends, it's just, you know, everyone's there before you.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just rough.
But like, well, there seem to be a fair number of people walking around in their ski gear, so I can only imagine that one run was fairly busy.
It's probably like a blues run as well.
Yeah, probably. And of course, you know, I mean, it wasn't great snow conditions anyway, so you can only wonder what the conditions were like when you got not a lot of snow and but a lot of skiers.
I mean, we'll see.
All right. Here we have a report about housing and the province's push to get municipalities to make more happen.
This is a CHY News update. MLA for Nanaimo Lanceville, George Anderson, is currently moving forward with a private member's bill that has sparked concern among local governments. Bill M216, Professional Alliance Act, introduced by Anderson, would change how local governments accept technical reports on housing developments by certified professionals. The bill is now in its committee stage after passing its second reading last week. If passed, local governments would have to accept reports prepared by certified professionals under the Professional Governments Act, or PGA, without staff review of any engineering reports or architectural designs. Anderson says these changes would reduce the amount of work needed, allowing building projects to be started more quickly delivering more homes in the province. MLA George Anderson spoke with CHY about his new bill.
Bill M216 is all about trying to bring the dream that many young people and families have of owning a home back into reality, and also have affordable housing, because every day, month, and year of delay are costs that are passed on to the end user, whether that's students who are trying to afford a place to rent in Nanaimo or Vancouver or Vernon, whether or not you're a first-time prospective home buyer. Every month of delay costs more. And
Anderson explains that currently, when a builder hires a professional, such as an engineer, geoscientist, or architect, for a building project, the professional must prepare technical reports and submit them to the relevant local government. The local government may then review the work.
Staff that are over capacity in the sense of the work that they need to do, it may mean that it may take a significant amount of time before an individual actually reviews that work. And so the faster that we're able to bring homes to market means that people who are looking to buy a home or to rent will end up having cheaper homes. And that's what the intent of this bill is to make sure that we can deliver homes for people faster.
This bill has already sparked some criticism over how it could disrupt local government approval authorities. President of the Union of British Columbia Municipalities, Corey Ramsey, told CHY that they are worried that the bill could undermine public safety and increase liability for local governments, putting homeowners and taxpayers at risk.
Homeowners and renters expect that due diligence has been provided when they move into a newly built home. And the purpose of peer review by local government staff is to ensure that there aren't errors in submissions that will lead to health, safety, or other problems in builds. The public might not be aware of this, but local government staff catch a lot of things developers have missed, and we work with developers to get it right. That's such a huge piece of the development process. And the process MLA Anderson is proposing will really make it harder for local governments to act, even when they see significant health and safety risks.
Anderson says that while this bill could cut some red tape from the approval process, getting housing built faster is a top priority and would allow local governments to focus on other important projects.
It's right in the legislation. It says that local communities, local governments are still in charge of zoning, bylaws, and official community plans. This bill would give local governments the opportunity to be able to focus on more high-level work, which would be great for our community, and further limit the liability that local governments have. So that means that the local government couldn't be sued. And I think that's actually a positive thing, because that means that that local government can spend money on buying parkland, fixing the roads, and creating the type of communities that we all want to live in.
While Ramsey understands the need for more housing throughout the province, she says there are just too many red flags in the bill to go untouched.
This bill expands the definition of a qualified professional, and now you're getting agrologists and biologists and people who don't have the same level of life safety experience in approving these types of really important pieces of infrastructure in our communities.
If passed in its current form, Ramsey says the bill will prevent local governments from conducting peer reviews of submissions made by a registered PGA professional. Under the legislation, municipalities will still have the chance to dispute any concerns with the PGA superintendent's office about whether the work should be redone. But this, Ramsey says, will just lead to more delays and higher costs for developers while they wait for an answer from the superintendent. She also touches on the risk the bill poses by shifting liability for damages from the local government to the PGA professional.
But what happens when a developer doesn't have the right liability coverage? What happens if, you know, you're building a commercial building and there's a $20 million deficiency and they only have $3 million worth of coverage? It's the taxpayer that's going to be on the hook for the difference. And so when I say this bill is broken, there's really some huge pieces to this that haven't been considered. And we want to make sure that taxpayers are protected.
While the bill has sparked some criticism, Anderson tells CHY that he is open to working with the UBCM and other concerned groups to make sure all voices are heard now that the bill is in the committee stage.
And what I can tell you is I want to work with people. I want to work with UBCM. I want to work with engineers and geoscientists of British Columbia, because people want us to work together. Like, housing isn't a partisan issue. we should all be coming together and saying, here's a bill that's been brought forward that can help a lot of people. Let's see how we can make it work.
With the bill in the committee stage, people can leave feedback through a portal on the Legislative Assembly of British Columbia website. Feedback can be given until January 6th of next year. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.